All right, thank you, John. And it is a pleasure to be here and to tell you about what happens when an experiment gets to the size of a nation state. So I'll start out with a review of what we know about neutrinos and why they might be interesting. And then I want to discuss this particular experiment, T to K, that I've been involved with for several years now. Why are we bothering? What are the various components that go into it? And this summer, we produced our very first results, and I guess this will be the first public presentation of most of that here at Toronto. So, and then I'll conclude with where things stand and what we can look for in the near future. Since this is a particle physics colloquium, I am required by law to show the following diagram, the periodic table of fundamental particles. So just to orient yourselves, first we have quarks. Up and down quarks are what we find inside protons and neutrons. If you just add an electron to that, you can start building atoms. You can do electricity, or have electricity, do chemistry. And so far, these three particles explain almost everything you encounter in your daily life. But there are other particles sitting around here. For example, each of these three light particles has heavier counterparts. For example, a top quark, which I'm sure you've heard of. Electrons have cousins like a mu and a tau. And in general, these other particles are just like the up-down quarks or the electron, but with a heavier mass. I don't think anyone has a really good understanding of why everything comes in triplicate. Must be some NSERC reporting requirement. I don't know. But what about this bottom row here, the neutrinos? What's up with that? Well, had you asked me 15 years ago, explain a neutrino, I would have had a pretty simple explanation. A neutrino is what you get if you start with an electron, you take away its electric charge, and you take away its mass. And you can imagine this may be a little disturbing to the poor particle. And you might be disturbed yourself asking, well, if I've taken an electron is a particle, I know it because it's charged, that's how we found them, and it has a mass, so what is left? In fact, neutrinos are sometimes called ghost particles because it sounds like, well, there'd be very little to them. Of course, neutrinos still have momentum and carry energy. There's no requirement in special relativity that things have mass to have energy. They also have angular momentum, or spin. In fact, here's something very peculiar about neutrinos. If you look at neutrinos coming towards you head on, every neutrino that ever has been seen, or probably you will ever see, is spinning clockwise, if you view it in the headlong direction. And I won't get into that, but it is very characteristic. And they can interact, but just barely. The reason we don't encounter these in our daily lives is simply that they tend to pass through us without stopping. The reason is that there are two ways a neutrino can interact. One is what we call a charged current process, where a neutrino can come in, trade what we call a W particle, which is a charged heavy particle, and in the process, a neutrino will turn into, for example, an electron. The other thing that can happen is a neutrino passes a Z particle across, and you can think of a Z particle as being like a very, very heavy photon, except it couples to neutrinos rather than the things with electric charge. And in either case, you have two ways in which a neutrino can trade some energy or momentum to another particle by passing one of these messengers across. And in one case, it can change from a neutrino into a charged particle. What makes neutrinos so weakly interacting is that these two particles, the W and Z, that transmit the weak force are extremely heavy. They have masses on the order of the mass of a gold atom. I guess a little lighter than that, sorry. I'm thinking of the top quark. They're as much as a heavy atom, right? And because they're so heavy, they have very short ranges. And so the cross-section for a neutrino to hit something as it's passing through matter is basically zero. You can have thousands of kilometers of matter, and a neutrino will just pass through as if it's not there, which is very important for the experiment I'm going to tell you about because that's exactly what we do with them. Like the other particles I mentioned, neutrinos come in threes. The distinction between them is what kind of charged leptons, so electrons, muons, or tau particles, they couple to. For example, an electron neutrino, you can almost define it. It's the neutrino that will produce an electron if you have a coupling to a W particle. Similarly, for a mu or a tau, and as a result, You can almost think that there's something like an electronness or a muness that's carried by the particle. So if you want to think, for example, that there's some muness, like a quantum number carried by a mu neutrino, then it gets transferred to the muon, that's a reasonable way to think about things. For example, if we have a muon, a particle that decays to produce a muon, it always produces a mu-type neutrino at the same time. If you then take that mu neutrino and let it travel a while, that mu neutrino, again, should only ever interact to produce another muon. And we give this a name. We call it conservation of flavor, conservation of the three kinds of leptons, if you like. Well, that's the simple version. If that's all there was to it, I wouldn't be giving this talk. It turns out neutrinos are a lot more complicated. And the idea is that we have a phenomenon called neutrino mixing. The concept here is that what we call an electron neutrino or a muon neutrino isn't just a pure state, but really that these are themselves quantum mechanical superposition of other neutrino states. I'll call them nu1 and nu2. And for example, you could think of this as a rotation in between the two bases. And the way to think of nu1 and nu2 is that these are neutrino states that have an exact, definite, well-defined mass. If you like, they're eigenstates of the free Hamiltonian as a neutrino is just traveling in space. But it's not necessarily the case that those combinations that show up in our weak interactions that interact to produce electrons or muons, for example, are identical to these. They could be related by some kind of mixing. So I have an analogy, a way to think about this. It's particularly designed for people who don't know quantum mechanics. I don't think probably no one in this audience falls into that category, but if you'll indulge me. One way to think of these two eigenstates, this nu1 and nu2, is imagine that there are two clocks inside a neutrino. And the setting of the clocks tells you what kind of neutrino you're dealing with. If the clocks read the exact same time, we say that that's an electron neutrino. The farthest apart they could be in time would be 6 hours. So if one clock is 6 hours ahead of the other, we call that combination a muon neutrino. And of course, you could have some intermediate position. So for example, if this clock is 4 hours ahead, then it's closer to being the muon state than the electron state. So let's say that two-thirds of the time, this will act like a muon neutrino, and the other third, it will act like an electron neutrino. So when we make a neutrino, it's always produced in one particular state or the other. For example, at time 0 or at 9:05, we make an electron neutrino. Both clocks read the same setting. We let the neutrino travel a while. An hour or so later, they still read the same time. It's still an electron neutrino. And as long as we wait, time passes, but as long as the clocks are in sync with each other, this is just an electron neutrino. What gets interesting is the case where the clocks can get out of sync. Let's say the red clock is running just a little bit faster, so that what starts out as an electron neutrino, a while later, the red clock is running fast, and now this combination looks like some intermediate state. In fact, in this particular way, I've got it so it's two-thirds of electron and one-third muon, because we've gone a third of the way around. And if you wait long enough, eventually you get a full 6 hours ahead, and this state, which was an electron neutrino, now is set to the muon neutrino state. And if you wait long enough, the red clock will continue to run, and it will catch up again with the blue clock, and you'll be back to being an electron neutrino. It's an oscillation effect. Why do you get a clock running out of sync? Well, it turns out that quantum mechanically, each of these mass eigenstates, if you solve the time-dependent Schrodinger equation, you pick up the regular quantum mechanical phase state. For example, for a plane wave solution, you've got a complex phase that depends on the energy and how time and the momentum and such. If you allow me to expand the energy in terms of the momentum and mass, E squared equals P squared plus M squared, what you get is that there's a term here that depends upon the mass. If the two clocks have slightly different masses, effectively they pick up slightly different quantum mechanical phases, and as the thing evolves over time, you start rotating one state with respect to the other. Basically, you make things get out of sync. There's actually a much simpler way to understand a fundamental point, which is that there is a relationship between mass and oscillation, simply because if you think about what if neutrinos really had zero mass? They'd travel at the speed of light, don't they? And if they travel at the speed of light, you have time dilation. Time dilation is infinite for something traveling at the speed of light. So in its own rest frame, no time passes. And you could never have the two clocks getting out of sync. So the fact that you could have an oscillation, in other words, the clocks get out of sync, means that at least something here can't be moving at the speed of light, and so there better be some mass. I have to anticipate the question. There is a very recent and very widely publicized report by an experiment in Europe that shines a beam of neutrinos from Geneva to Italy, saying that they measured the speed of a neutrino and it broke the speed of light just by, you know, 3 parts in 10 to the 5. Wow. So, of course, people want to know, well, what do you have to say about this? Are you going to do this measurement? So let me just make the following. I didn't really want to talk about this, but I really don't have a lot of choice. The experiment I'm going to tell you today, we have to upgrade our clocks if we want to do a direct test of this measurement, and it will take us a little bit of time to do that. We have to buy clocks, etc. But don't worry. If we do, in fact, find that neutrinos travel faster than the speed of light, we will use that fact to submit our findings backwards in time, and they will appear in PRL yesterday. They didn't? I guess maybe we can make a conclusion on what we expect to find then. There has been all sorts of debate about whether this result is worth even paying attention to. And until the question period, I'm going to pretend this never happened. I think that is safest. But let me go back to what I do want to talk about, which is this flavor oscillation business, how a neutrino could change from one type to the other through quantum mechanics. As I said, this can happen if you have two mass eigenstates with slightly different masses, and just writing out the math, if they have slightly different masses, M1 and M2, you can work out the probability as a function of how far the neutrino has traveled, in the limit that the neutrinos are moving very close to the speed of light, that what started as an electron neutrino will still act like it'll appear as an electron neutrino at a later time. It depends first on a mixing angle, theta, which is how much mixing there is between these states. It depends upon the difference in the masses, m squared, so m1 squared minus m2 squared. You see m squared appears in the phase factor. Depends how far you travel, L, and goes like 1 over energy simply, if you want to think of that as just time dilation. You know, it's a gamma factor, a Lorentz factor. That's all it is. But there's this very peculiar looking sine squared of L over E. It's a characteristic signature of this sort of oscillation. So the first experiment that saw really conclusive evidence that this sort of thing happened was an experiment in Japan called Super Kamiokande. And I'll have more to say about that later because it's integral to the rest of my talk. But what Super K did was that they were looking at neutrinos produced in the atmosphere. So the Earth is being rained on by cosmic rays coming from all directions, and those cosmic rays will hit air molecules and they can produce neutrinos in the upper atmosphere. So what Super K did was they looked at neutrinos coming from above, you know, right, they were produced just overhead, compared to neutrinos produced on the far side of the Earth. And those neutrinos are, of course, you know, 20-something thousand kilometers away or whatever. I guess not quite that far. But what they found was that they could look at electron neutrinos and muon neutrinos in their detector. When they looked at the electron neutrinos, they saw that they had basically equal number of neutrinos coming from above as below. And the number of neutrinos as a function of energy and angle just agreed perfectly with what they thought the atmosphere ought to be producing. But then they looked at the muon neutrinos, and they found something very mysterious. The neutrinos coming from above were present in just the number they expected. The neutrinos coming from the far side of the Earth, half of them were gone. And furthermore, that disappearance effect, the muon neutrinos just not being there, was different at lower energy compared to higher energy. And this sort of dependence on, well, the ones coming from above are produced a lot farther away. So there's the dependence on length. And then I said there's also a dependence on energy. And they saw that sort of thing, and they found that this model, the only way they could fit this model is with some kind of oscillation. It really fit perfectly, which is what this line going through the data points is meant to represent. It's an oscillation model. It looked like the muon neutrinos are vanishing in flight. They're not turning into electron neutrinos, or else you'd have seen a big excess in one of these plots. Most likely, they're turning into tau neutrinos on the way, which Super K wasn't sensitive to see. Next, here in Canada, we started looking at solar neutrinos in the SNOW experiment. And what we saw was that if you look at neutrinos coming from the sun should only ever be making electron neutrinos in the nuclear reactions that power it. But in fact, if you look at the neutrinos, the number of electron neutrinos seems to be about only one-third of the total number of neutrinos that SNOW could detect coming from the sun, which told you the other two-thirds had turned into either new mus or new taus on their way to Earth. So being here in Canada, I'm sure you've heard this story many times before. In Japan, they followed up with an experiment where they looked at neutrinos produced by nuclear reactors, and they saw that if you sit about 200 kilometers away from a reactor, some of the neutrinos were missing, and they were missing in an energy-dependent way. The high-energy ones were all there, but the low-energy ones were missing. Again, there's this funny energy dependence in neutrino oscillation. And if you took the solar neutrino data and the reactor neutrino data and you tried to interpret this as, if I were going to fit this with an oscillation, I have two free parameters, a delta m squared, the difference in the masses squared, and a mixing angle theta. And they found that these two very different classes of experiments were all fit by one common solution. In particular, this solution implied that the difference in the masses was very, very tiny. So this axis here is a few parts in 10 to the minus 5 electron volts squared. So it gives you an idea that the scale of a neutrino mass is roughly a million times lighter than an electron, more or less. Very tiny. So that brings me to the main event today, the T decay experiment. So the idea here is we're going to build a man-made beam of neutrinos. We do this with a facility called the Japan Proton Research Accelerator Complex, or JPARC. It's here in the eastern side of Japan, right on the Pacific Ocean. Here's Tokyo, I guess over there. And here we are on the ocean. This is basically a very intense proton beam. If we slam it into a target, we can make neutrinos, as I'll describe, and you shoot a beam of almost pure muon-type neutrinos right through Japan. And on the far side, we have this Super Kamiokande neutrino detector. And what we want to do then is we also put a near detector right here. So we're going to measure the neutrinos with a detector right at the production point. And then at the far end, 300 kilometers away, and we're going to do a before and after comparison. And what we're trying to see are any of the neutrinos changing from one type to the other as they travel across Japan. So here's our tabletop. You have to be a little bit careful. On this sort of scale, the curvature of the Earth matters. So if you want to make sure your beam gets to your detector, you actually have to point the beam just a little bit down. And at its maximum depth, it's about 1,000 meters below the surface of the Earth, and then it comes back out on the other side. Now, T decay was not the first experiment to hit upon this idea of shooting a beam a long distance. There was a previous experiment in Japan called K decay, which is based a very similar concept, and an experiment in the US called MINOS, and I won't go through the details of those for time reasons, but basically, in a preliminary way, they each looked at a beam of neutrinos and saw that some of the neutrinos were disappearing in a way that looked like neutrino oscillations. For example, K to K had this kind of funny wiggle pattern, and MINOS actually fit for the oscillation probability and saw this kind of dip pattern, which is characteristic of oscillations. And when they looked at what mixing parameters they got something that was very consistent with what the atmospheric neutrino studies that I mentioned previously were saying. So there seemed to be a very consistent picture that you could explain all of this disappearing effects, whether it's with atmospheric neutrinos or long baseline neutrinos or solar neutrinos, with some kind of oscillation picture. So at present, this oscillation picture is on very solid footing. But in reality, we ought to think in three dimensions. We have three kinds of neutrinos, not just nu e and nu mu. There's also nu tau. And so we have presumably three mass eigenstates which we can mix together. And if you write down, well, I want a 3x3 unitary matrix to relate one basis to the other, it turns out you can always factor that basis or parameterize it in terms of a product of three matrices that depend upon three mixing angles, theta 2, 3, theta 1, 3, theta 1, 2, and a possible complex phase delta inside one of those matrices. So the basic idea here is if you take any two of the neutrino states, for example, nu 1 and nu 2, and look at oscillations involving those two states, you can kind of pick off a particular mixing angle. And for example, solar neutrino mixing seems to be controlled by mixing between the first and the second neutrino state. And you can measure a mixing angle, and what's sort of interesting is that mixing angle is pretty large, larger than people ever expected it could be. With atmospheric neutrinos, you're looking at, in this case, the second and the third mass states, and look at how they control a mixing, and you get a very large mixing. In fact, we call this maximal mixing because if you look at this matrix, it looks like the diagonal and the off-diagonal elements of this corner here are basically of equal size. And then finally, there's a third combination, the third and the first state. And we don't know a lot about this right now. There's a mixing angle theta 1, 3, which is believed to be small and probably consistent with zero, at least according to previous results. And we don't understand why. And this delta thing, the reason delta would be interesting is if delta is there, this would allow a neutrino and an antineutrino to oscillate differently. So I'll come back to that in a moment. But what we would like to do in T decay is concentrate on this theta 1, 3, this unmeasured mixing parameter. The idea here is that when you were looking at atmospheric neutrinos or long baseline neutrinos, what people seem to have been seeing was muon neutrinos turning into tau neutrinos. So it's an open question, why don't we ever see a muon neutrino turning into an electron neutrino? Well, it works out that if you write out the full 3x3 mixing formalism and solve the Schrodinger equation, to first order, ignoring various complications, the probability of a muon neutrino turning into an electron neutrino in flight directly depends upon this small mixing parameter, theta 1, 3. So the idea in the T decay experiment is we take a beam of muon neutrinos and see if any of them turn into electron neutrinos. And if they do, we call that theta 1, 3. Why would that be useful? Well, what makes it interesting is that as soon as you have the possibility of a muon neutrino turning into an electron neutrino, you could also ask, do antineutrinos, do the antimatter counterparts act the same way? Do they have, for example, equal oscillation probabilities? You can do lots and lots of complicated algebra and work out that if, you know, the difference in the oscillation probabilities over their sum, for example, depends upon almost all the mixing parameters that people ever cared about in a neutrino, times this possible CP-violating phase. So what? That's a perfectly legitimate question. It sounds like I'm just measuring a bunch of esoteric parameters in a matrix. But fundamentally, we have a problem with our universe. And the problem is that we look around and we see that we are in a universe that is dominated by matter and not antimatter. The Big Bang, we believe, should have produced equal amounts of each. So how did we get to a situation where we have this big excess of matter? Well, the story has been around for almost 40 years now that one of the ways you can produce a matter-antimatter asymmetry in the universe, there are three conditions you need to satisfy, called the Sakharov conditions. And one of those is that you have to have a fundamental asymmetry in how matter and antimatter behave at the particle physics level, if you like. People have spent the last 40 years looking at how quarks behave and comparing quarks with anti-quarks. And while they see that quarks and anti-quarks behave a little bit differently, the size of that asymmetry just isn't enough to explain the sort of world we live in. But once I have neutrinos that can oscillate and introduce all these new parameters we have to measure, you suddenly have a whole new sector of physics where you can have a matter-antimatter asymmetry. And at least in many models, you can work out that a neutrino is behaving differently between matter and antimatter. In the early universe, under certain conditions, could produce a universe that's dominated by matter today. So ultimately, this is where we'd like to go with this in the long term. It is possible that neutrinos are the reasons we're all here today. They're certainly the reason I'm here today, but that's a different story. So conceptually, this is a simple experiment. We take a beam of new mu's, as pure as we can make it. We see if any of them turn into nu e in flight. And what we're really looking for at our far detector is something we call a charge-current quasi-elastic interaction. So what that simply means is an electron neutrino, which is what we hope to find, interacting with a neutron to make an electron and a proton. This is a challenging measurement. We have a beam which is almost all muon neutrinos, and we expect that the number of electron neutrinos appearing will be very few. So we have to really understand the backgrounds. And if we did the backgrounds, if we understood it well and we collect enough data, in principle, we're designed to basically push down a factor of 20 below the current limits on how big theta 1-3 could be. At the same time, we do have all of those muon neutrinos, so we can repeat the measurements that people have done previously looking at how muon neutrinos disappear, but with a lot more statistics and accuracy. And, for example, we think that with enough power, we could measure an energy spectrum of the neutrinos and see distinctive wiggles in it that would give you a very precise measurement of, for example, the differences in the masses. And once again, we like to use these quasi-elastic events where basically the neutrino turns directly into a muon in this case. So let me mention where the current limit on this theta 1-3 parameter comes from. Surprisingly, it doesn't actually come from these long baseline experiments, but it comes from a reactor neutrino experiment. I mentioned that people have done experiments where they look at neutrinos coming out of nuclear reactors and see, do you see as many neutrinos as the reactor power says that ought to be produced, or do you see a deficit? And for example, the CAMLAN experiment at about 200 kilometers saw that the number of neutrinos coming out was about 60% of what the reactor power said should have been there. And they inferred that the neutrinos were oscillating, and they drew this nice little oscillation curve. But it works out that if you sit about 2 kilometers from a nuclear reactor, you also should see disappearance, but at a very different baseline. There's a term here, because it's depending upon a different mass splitting, it is sensitive to energy, bigger mass splitting, lower distance, and that probability depends upon theta 1-3. So the previous best limit on how big theta 1-3 was to build an experiment that sat a couple kilometers from a reactor and looked, do we have any deficit of neutrinos? And what this show experiment saw was that the number of neutrinos produced by the reactor agreed with the prediction from the power output, and they set an upper limit on how good this could be. So that's the target against we want to race, but we're looking with a very different experimental technique. So how do you make a neutrino beam? Well, you start with a proton beam, essentially. So this is the canonical cartoon of what a particle accelerator starts like. You have a straight segment we call the LINAC. You get things going. You whip them around a few times. You get them faster. You whip them around a little more on a bigger beam. And in this case, we actually extract them off and point the proton beam west towards the far side of Japan. How do you turn those protons into neutrinos? Well, basically you slam them into a big chunk of graphite. It's a little more complicated than that, but the protons hit the graphite, and like any high-energy particle collision, you make a whole spray of particles, especially pions that come out. You then have a set of what we call magnetic horns. These are just devices that I'll show you a picture that produce a toroidal magnetic field that focuses this beam of pions into a long collimated pipe. You have a long pipe of pions then going along here, and pions in flight will decay to produce a muon and a muon neutrino. You hit the end of the pipe, you've got some dirt, the muons stop in the dirt, neutrinos keep on going, and all you're left with in the end is a beam of neutrinos going mostly in the forward direction. One thing I thought I should advertise is the local contribution here. So John and the Toronto group and the group across town at York built something for this experiment called the Optical Transition Radiation Monitor, or the OTR. Basically, it's just a little thin metallic foil you stick in the proton beam just in front of the graphite target. And the idea here is you want to measure that proton beam's position and width, for example. And it's an extremely intense beam. It will destroy from the irradiation, it'll destroy most monitors, but a little thin foil can survive. And what happens is as the protons go through the foil, they're going through a sudden change in the index of refraction. And if you go back to the later chapters of Jackson's E&M, it tells you something called transition radiation, where a charged particle that goes through a quick transition in index of refraction will radiate. And this radiation is actually optical. You can put a whole series of mirrors and focus it onto a camera and take a picture. And this picture, if you interpret it properly, tells you where the proton beam hit the target and how wide it was. And so we use this as every time we run the beam. After that beam goes through the monitor and hits the target, we put it through one of these focusing horns. So this is basically just a magnetized device that produces a toroidal magnetic field to collimate this beam of pions. And we shove it down this 100-meter-long evacuated pipe and let them decay to make the neutrinos. One interesting wrinkle of this is that we don't aim the beam directly at our super K detector at the far end. Instead, we steer it about 2.5 degrees over to the side. And that sounds like a peculiar thing to do, but what it works out is almost by coincidence that as you move the beam off axis, what tends to happen to the energy spectrum of the neutrinos you get out is it gets very narrowly peaked and it goes lower in energy. The reason for that is illustrated by this graph, which shows the longitudinal and transverse momentum of neutrinos produced by pions of particular energies. And you see if you go along the x-axis, these are neutrinos that are all going in the forward direction. Pions of very different energies will make neutrinos of very different energies. But if you look at these ellipses, they all tend to pile up in one little region here, which means that if you go up at an angle like there, pions of very different energies will tend to produce neutrinos of all the same energy, which is why if you go off a little bit of axis, you actually get an enhancement or a focusing effect. And so this allows us to basically make a narrow beam where we can choose the energy of the beam to be wherever we want it to be just by shifting the angle. And we can sort of put the neutrinos at the energy that we expect them to oscillate at to make the measurement as efficient as we can. So it's about time I introduce this far detector, Super K, which I keep mentioning. So here's the proper introduction. It's a big tank of water. Okay, a little more complicated. It's about 40 meters across, 40 meters high. It's got 50 kilotons of water, and all the sides and top and bottom are lined with about 11,000 photomultiplier tubes, very large photomultiplier tubes, sensitive to individual photons. And what we're looking for are neutrinos to come in, interact very, very rarely with the water, and they, for example, might produce an electron or a muon. And those electrons or muons will be moving faster than the speed of light in water. Here's the one thing moving faster than the speed of light I don't have to be embarrassed about. And that produces an effect called Cherenkov radiation, also found in the last chapters of Jackson. And basically, the charged particle moving faster than the local speed of light in a medium with an index of refraction will radiate in a nice cone. And you look for a cone of light hitting the side of the detector. For example, here is a muon-like ring. So we believe this was a muon in Super K. A muon neutrino interacted. We produce a muon that starts, you see it starting inside the tank. And of course, you can see how much energy it has by how much light was produced. And you get this nice sharp ring. Electrons look something like this. And maybe if the lights were off, it'd be a little clearer. But you can see maybe that the ring is a bit smeared out. There's a lot of fuzz around it. And what's going on there is that if you make an electron, the electron is so light that it gets easily buffeted as it moves through the water. And so instead of moving in a nice straight line, it kind of jitters around and sort of smears out the whole pattern. So basically what we're doing is we see neutrinos by these rings, and we look at how clean or sharp the ring is to say, is it a muon, or is it some fuzzy smeared out thing that might be an electron? So really what we're expecting is we're going to see lots and lots of these, and very rarely events that look like that. But we have to worry about what else is there besides neutrino oscillations that could look like an electron. One problem is our beam, although I said it's almost 99% muon neutrinos, there is just a little bit of electron neutrinos intrinsic to the beam that are produced right at the start. And that's a background. It's very hard to get rid of. You just really have to measure it in the near detector so you know what the baseline level of electron neutrinos is. And then one which is particularly insidious is what we call pi zero production. So pi zero is one of the particles you could produce in a neutrino interaction. And a pi zero particle will decay very quickly to make two gamma rays. If you're lucky, you see, oh, here's a ring. I've got two rings. There were two gamma rays. This was a pion. Don't worry about it. It's a background. But if you were unfortunate enough that you miss one of the rings, for example, if the two gamma rays come out almost in the same direction so the rings overlap, or if one of them is much lower in energy, you might fail to notice that there's a second ring and think, oh, this looks like just an electron. In fact, this event here is actually a pion. We know because we simulated it. Can you see the second ring? Yeah, me neither. I'm told it's kind of about right there. And if you have a very good reconstruction routine that can look for faint rings and fit it, you can tell that it's there. But this is the sort of thing you have to worry about. We expect that if we ran the experiment for the full length of time, we might see between these two sources of backgrounds on the order of 25 events. And how many signal events we see? Well, if theta-1-3 is very small, we might only see 20 signal. But theta-1-3 could be, say, a factor of 10 bigger, in which case we have 200 events versus 25, which would be a very clean signal. How do you know that you really understand the backgrounds? Well, you build this fancy near detector. And this is what I've spent a lot of my time worrying about for the last several years. This is a big magnetized detector. So this is a giant magnet. It's 7 meters long, 3.5 meters inner diameter. And inside, you put this whole slew of neutrino detectors. And the ones I want to concentrate are the ones we built here in Canada, the Tracker. These are 3 time projection modules and 3 fine-grained detector modules, which I'll tell you more about in a second. The basic idea is that we have long, thin strips of plastic scintillator with wavelength-shifting fibers running down the middle. We wait for a neutrino to interact in the plastic, and if it does, it might produce a muon, for example, and that muon will produce scintillation light as it moves through the plastic. So a fine-grained detector is just big, thin stacks of scintillator. We put beside it these time projection chambers, which is just a big box full of gas, and we can measure the ionization of the gas as a charged particle goes through, right? Methods I don't want to get into right now. But what you're hoping to see is something like this. A muon neutrino comes in, interacts inside one of the fine-grained detectors and makes a muon and a proton. We can track them as they leave light in the scintillator or as they ionize the gas. And because it's in a magnetic field, we can measure the curvature of the track and get some idea of the momentum or the charge of the particle as well. So we're going to try to measure this, and we can measure the muon neutrinos, and we could also look for electron-like tracks. And we could also, by various other means, try to measure the rate at which pi zeros get produced by neutrinos, which is one of our other backgrounds. With that in hand, you do what is really a simple analysis in the end. It's not simple when you do it, but it sounds simple. We're going to predict how many neutrinos are produced by our beam. After all, we know how powerful our beam is, and we can make a prediction of how many neutrinos ought to come out. We don't want to rely solely on that, dead reckoning. So we use our near detector to verify the prediction and check that we got the overall normalization right. Based upon that model, we extrapolate how many neutrinos should we see at super K, of either electron type or muon type, and then look at what we got. So there are two results I'll present today. One is looking for electron neutrinos, and this is a result that came out in June and has appeared in PRL now. And this was our full data set, up through the earthquake. More on that later. And then in August, we put out some newer results saying what are the muon neutrinos doing? And I'll show those today as well. But first, let's start with this flux prediction. How do we predict how many neutrinos the beam should have made? Really, this is a very detailed and sophisticated simulation of how protons interact in a chunk of graphite to produce pions and how well we focus those. So Mark Hartz here for UT is an expert in this sort of thing. And effectively, you use other experiments which have measured how many, for example, how many pions do you produce if one proton hits a nucleus of carbon. And you do those sorts of measurements. And you can make 10, 20% accuracy predictions of what the neutrino energy spectrum should be at the near detector or at the far detector. And for example, what fraction are muon neutrinos, what fraction are electron neutrinos, and so on. It's basically a dead reckoning prediction. We then look at our near detector. For example, here's an actual event where we had a neutrino hit this fine-grained detector and leave some nice tracks. And we do what we call an inclusive charge current muon analysis. Basically, we're looking for any events that look like muons that were produced by neutrinos. The signature will see a nice long curving track, curving in the right direction. We can check that it's really a muon by looking at how much energy it deposits as it ionizes the gas, for example, in the time projection chambers. And different particles will produce different amounts of ionization depending on their mass and their charge. For example, I call this particle ID plot. This is the momentum versus effectively how much energy is deposited. And muons always produce a characteristic curve here. And so you can look at any track, see, well, it was at this momentum based on its curvature. Was the energy consistent with a muon or not? And there's a few percent background you have to worry about from other rare processes. But effectively, you just count how many muons you've got. And we did that. We looked at, for example, the momentum of the muons, and they agreed with what our beam prediction said it should be. We looked at the angular distribution of the muons. Again, it was a pretty good match. And even the overall rate. Our measured rate was about 4% different than what our beam prediction said and agreed, in fact, with the experimental uncertainty. So, at the 6 or 7% level, we've measured how many neutrinos are in the beam right at the start. We then look at super K. Remember, we're looking for electron neutrinos appearing. So you want to have a ring that looks like an electron. You want to make sure that there isn't a following electron. So what could happen maybe is if you had a muon will eventually stop in the detector, and when it decays, it'll make an electron. So if you see a second electron in the event, more likely there was a muon somewhere in there, and you want to just throw that out just to be safe. Even if you thought the first ring was an electron, maybe you got it wrong. You make sure that the energy is right where you expect. We know at what energy the neutrinos ought to be oscillating. And you look very carefully with your good fitter to make sure there's not some hidden little ring somewhere that means that this was really a pi zero. With these various selection criteria, how many electron neutrino event candidates do we see? The answer is we saw 6. Our background predictions were shown in the green and the light blue. Basically, we should have seen very few. I'll get to how few in a moment. The red is where the neutrinos would occur in energy if they were really oscillating, which not a bad fit to where we actually see the neutrinos. The particular backgrounds are first electron neutrinos intrinsic to the beam that were there right at the start. About 0.8 events we expect to see. That's the expected rate of that. Sometimes we mess up and we mistake a pi zero event for an electron. We think that's about 0.6. And there is a tiny little contribution from another kind of neutrino oscillation, which isn't what we're looking for, but there's a subdominant effect that depends upon this other mixing angle, theta 1, 2. It just gives a minor contribution. But overall, if theta 1, 3 were actually 0, we would expect to see about 1.5 events. We saw 6. The chance probability of 1.5 Poisson fluctuating to 6 is 0.7%. If you think of this in terms of statistical significances or how many sigmas, what people always ask me, the answer is 2.5. Exciting? Not convincing. No one should be writing to the New York Times on 2.5 sigma sorts of things, but that's all the data we have, and this is what we got. I'll skip that for time and go to what is this. If you believe that this is telling you something about theta 1, 3, and this is a real hint of a signal, what could you infer? So I have here first a plot showing theta 1, 3 versus the mass splitting. The show experiment I mentioned previously had a limit at this blue region. T decay's preferred region is this colored band, so these are the 68 and 90% confidence intervals. And in fact, our best fit, which is about right in this region, is just about or maybe slightly lower than the current show limit. You could also plot this in terms of what you know about the CP violating phase. At this point, any CP violating phase is perfectly consistent. We can't tell with just measuring neutrinos alone. But again, we're getting a best fit that says that theta 1, 3 might be around 0.1. Kind of right at the current limit of what the previous experiment said it could be. Very much on the large side. We desperately want more data to see if this effect continues or whether this was just a statistical fluke. We then went on to look at the muon neutrinos. If neutrinos didn't oscillate at all, based upon what we saw in our near detector, we should have seen about 104 muon neutrinos at super K. We saw 31, a big effect. It's this disappearance effect. Just like every other experiment, the neutrinos seem to be disappearing in flight. We looked at the energies of the neutrinos, measured at super K. If there were no oscillations, we should have seen a big spike in energies right here around 1 GeV of energy. That spike is just missing. Instead, we have something that fits an oscillation model that actually is really pretty consistent with what other experiments have seen. For example, the super K measurements said that the mass splittings for atmospheric neutrinos was around 2.5 × 10⁻³ eV squared and a very big mixing angle. T decay, yeah, we're not as good yet. We have a much bigger contour, but you know, at least in the mass, we're already competitive. But this was done with 2% of our full data set, of what our eventual full data set will be. So imagine this contour becoming 7 times smaller, which is about what we would guess. So we think we're going to dominate the world measurement of this in a few years. Why don't we dominate it already? Well, we had a little trouble. Everyone knows about the terrible earthquake that hit Japan in March. So here is where the earthquake epicenter was. We are about right here. We are directly on the coast, directly in the affected region. We were very fortunate. Of course, we were fortunate that no one from our experiment or even from the lab was injured in the earthquake, and that was our foremost worry. But it turns out, not only that, but even the tsunami itself didn't reach the lab. Even though we're literally like 400 meters from the coast, but there's a big berm that happened to be just tall enough to stop the wave. Most of the buildings, well, the Japanese, if nothing, know how to build an earthquake, to survive an earthquake, and the buildings didn't take much damage either. Everything shut down. This summer, we went in and we tested our detectors. They still work. And yes, there's some refurbishing that has to be done globally in the lab. A lot of the problems we have were, for example, this beam, which was very carefully aligned to begin with, now, you know, elements have shifted by millimeters or even a centimeter in some cases. You have to spend a lot of time aligning everything, and you have to, the biggest real damage was that the ground shifted. Buildings were anchored to the bedrock. They were fine. But the ground next to them sometimes sank by 2 meters, and for example, the electrical cables and plumbing running in the ground suddenly got yanked 2 meters relative to the wall of the building, and so everything gets disconnected and we have to reroute it. But incredibly enough, we think we're going to restart in December, which if the end result of that earthquake is that we're back running 9 months later, I consider that a very fortunate outcome. And really, we didn't lose all that much time because we shut off for the summer anyway. So maybe we've lost 4 or 5 months, and it could have been a lot, lot worse. So we're thanking our lucky stars right now. But as we begin to ramp up and get more power, ultimately, we aim to push down as low as we can. So this is sort of how our limit, our sensitivity to theta-1-3 depends on how much exposure, how many years of running effectively we get. Right now, we're sitting right up here. This plot was originally made before we took any data with the idea that we were to push our limit down as far as we can. On the other hand, if theta-1-3 holds up to be as large as our first hint suggests, you can imagine that if, you know, 3 or 4 times more data than we have now, this could turn into a 4, 5 sigma sort of thing, that a point where you might consider claiming a discovery. Obviously, we're not there yet. I hope no one misinterprets anything I've said today to say we've claimed anything yet. But let's just say we're very motivated to get more data. So let me conclude. We have an indication in our first data that maybe muon neutrinos are turning into electron neutrinos as they travel across the length of Japan. 2.5 sigma. 2.5 sigma is not statistically compelling by anyone's definition, but we're paying close attention. More data, we hope, as soon as December, if things go well. We looked at our muon neutrinos. They are consistent with what all the oscillation pictures say we should see. Even though we have very low statistics still, we're just a very well-designed experiment for that kind of measurement because we have this off-axis angle, for example, and this near detector. So we think in the long term we're going to, you know, we hope ultimately that we will discover significant evidence that theta-1-3 is not zero, do the world's best measurements of the other neutrino mixings, and longer term maybe start looking at how antineutrinos compare. So that's it. I thank you for your attention.